Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today's A-List Economic Report gross domestic product was what you might fairly call a mixed bag. Yes, we are growing, but the hole we were in when we started was a lot deeper than we thought. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy Friday, gang. It is the 30th of July today. Always good to have you with us. The second quarter of 2010 in the American economy wasn't all that bad. The Commerce Department told us that gross domestic product rose 2.4% April through June, a completely respectable number, really, given the way that housing has been going, and more to the point, the way that unemployment is still going. And that brings us to this. Businesses were the big drivers behind the growth last quarter, specifically businesses buying lots of new equipment and computers. The idea being that all that new stuff is going to make workers more productive so that companies don't have to hire new workers. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more.
There's evidence in today's report of a big jump in corporate investment. Business spending on new equipment and software increased almost 22% in the second quarter. That's the fastest rate in 12 years. Nigel Galt is chief U.S. economist for IHS Global Insight. He says CEOs are being cautious about hiring.
They see the cost of adding equipment now is less for them than the cost of adding a permanent worker.
After all, you don't have to worry about health insurance or retirement plans for new computers, so you throw new gear at your workers to make them more efficient. But
that can't go on forever. People can only move so fast.
Alan Levinson is chief economist at T. Rowe Price.
And we really started to see that tipping point at the end of last year and the beginning of this year.
Levinson says when businesses reach that tipping point where even the shiniest new gizmo couldn't wring any more productivity out of their workers, they did start hiring. A little. Although we're still a long way from making up the more than 8 million jobs we lost during the recession. Now, you may be thinking, what about the companies that make the equipment and software other businesses are buying? Don't they have to hire extra people? Yes, but not necessarily in the U.S. Quincy Crosby is a market strategist at Prudential Financial.
Of the hiring that is being done, it's a higher percentage overseas.
But Crosby does expect U.S. hiring to pick up next year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve has been doing its darndest to get things going again. It has flooded the financial system with money, liquidity, as we've been telling you. It's lowered interest rates to encourage more spending, too. And that has a lot of people worried about whether all that cash would lead to inflation. Not only has that not happened, now there are some within the Fed saying that the big worry could be just the opposite. Deflation. Not just lower prices, but lower prices over a prolonged period of time. Officially, prices aren't falling just yet, but some experts think it is time to come up with a plan just in case they do. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
From a consumer standpoint, deflated prices may sound like a great idea. If you want people to buy things, after all, just lower the price. But there's a big difference between throwing a sale and making declining prices a regular fixture. Tom Porcelli is an economist at RBC Markets. He points to the way the Japanese economy has languished for the better part of two decades.
People had come to expect in Japan that prices would continue to fall. And so it becomes very self-fulfilling. If you think prices are going to continue to fall, then you'll put off purchases.
It can become a vicious cycle, especially vicious when falling prices turn into falling profits. Companies produce less and cut more jobs. But how might the Fed reverse that cycle? Barry Bosworth is a financial policy expert at the Brookings Institution. He says the central bank may have already spent the ammunition it might normally aim at deflation.
In an inflation episode, it raises interest rates. In a deflation episode, it would lower interest rates. The problem is it hits zero, and it can't really do any more than that on the interest rate.
Bosworth is evidence of the way opinion is divided over how much of a threat deflation might be. He's doubtful American consumers are simply holding off, waiting for better prices. He says they're still spending where they can, just not where they can't.
The housing market's been devastated. People aren't holding off there. They just don't have the money to buy a house, and a lot of other people are in trouble paying for the house they have.
Bosworth says the way to get people spending again is focusing on what's really a stagnant economy and getting more people back to work. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It's still a point of macroeconomic debate as to when, or in some circles, whether, China is going to pass the U.S. and become the biggest economy in the world. But it does look like they've nailed down the number two spot. In Beijing today, a senior economic official said China has passed Japan for number two. But all that economic development brings growth of other things as well. In China's case, air pollution. A report over there this week said Chinese cities are seeing the worst air quality they've had in 5 years. So we asked Marketplace's Chrissy Clark to explore the relationship between dirty air and the economy here.
Let's begin with the obvious. Whether you're in China or the U.S., the more the economy is buzzing, the more it's spewing. More construction projects are happening.
More people are driving and factories are producing more products. When that happens, there's more pollution. Pretty simple.
That's MIT economist Michael Greenstone. Air quality data during the current recession isn't out yet, but Greenstone studied how the last recession in the early 1980s affected the air we breathe. The numbers were startling. The U.S. cities hit the hardest in places like the Rust Belt also saw their air pollution drop, which raises the question, can you have good air quality and economic growth? Greenstone says yes. He points to long-term trends. Since the 1970s, the American economy has grown dramatically, while overall emissions have shrunk.
And the reason is we now have much stricter regulations than we did in the early 1970s.
And industry has figured out how to make money in spite of them. It helped that the country moved from an industrial and manufacturing base to one with more office work and service jobs. But economist Matt Kahn from UCLA says tighter regulations can cut another way.
During recessions, people are less likely to support environmental regulation as a public policy priority. And if environmental regulations are slowed or not enforced, then that can actually degrade the environment.
And whether you're in the U.S. or China, Kahn says there's one reason we should all breathe easy.
Pollution makes urban, productive people sick, and a healthy workforce is the key to economic growth.
I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
By the bell on Wall Street today, traders had pretty much worked that GDP report out of their systems. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The Franklin Mills Shopping Mall, not far from downtown Philadelphia, is an unlikely spot for the Army to have set up camp. But for 2 years, that's where the Pentagon has deployed some of its most valuable assets, state-of-the-art helicopter and Humvee simulators that cost millions of dollars. The Army says their marketing experience has been a success, even as they pack up their simulators and video game consoles and go home ahead of schedule. From Philadelphia, Joel Rose reports.
It's Friday night at the Army Experience Center in Northeast Philadelphia. About a dozen young men sit in front of a wall of Xbox consoles, trying to beat each other at Halo 3, a popular first-person shooter game. These guys have played in a lot of Halo tournaments here over the last 2 years, so there's a last day of summer camp vibe as the players turn in their controllers and say goodbye to the staff. But Army spokesman Brian Lepley isn't being sentimental when he declares the center's two-year mission a success.
We saw the Army Experience Center as a marketing technology lab.
Lepley says the Army Experience Center, which cost about $22 million to build and operate, was not a traditional recruiting station. Instead, it was a place for the Army to test out high-tech gadgets, including simulators designed to reproduce combat missions in helicopters and Humvees.
Over 40,000 people came in and out of the Army Experience Center, you know, got in a simulator for a Humvee, got in a Black Hawk simulator, played the video games, used the interactive touchscreen technology to learn about the Army.
But if the center is such a success, critics wonder why it's closing.
They're closing early. I mean, they still had a few months left in their lease, so we're very happy.
Bill Deckard is a peace activist from nearby Bucks County, Pennsylvania. From the day the center opened, protesters held demonstrations and vigils. Deckard objects to its location, across from an indoor skate park in a busy shopping mall, and to the way the Army described the center's mission.
When the Army people would talk about it and they would say, oh, no, it's not a recruiting center, at the end of their statement, they would talk about how the recruiting was doing. To me, it was very dishonest.
Deckard and his fellow peace activists see the center's closing as a victory, but the Army denies that. They say it has more to do with changes in the U.S. labor market. When plans for the Army Experience Center were drawn up in 2007, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were raging, the economy was booming, and the Army had a hard time making its recruiting goals. RAND Corporation economist Beth Ash says that's no longer the case.
Even though those wars continue, the economy is much worse, and that helps recruiting. They've not only met their recruiting goals, they've exceeded them, and they've exceeded them with higher quality people.
Spokesman Brian Lepley says the Army will probably make its goals again this year. Still, he says it won't be long before traditional recruiting stations get some of the high-tech tools the Army tested in Philadelphia.
Our main target age to get people to join the Army is obviously 17 to 24. We have got to reach them the way that they entertain themselves. They all have cell phones. They all have a laptop, maybe another handheld. This is what they've grown up on. We can't ignore that.
Video games may be a cost-effective way to get young people's attention, but anti-war protester Kathy Leary does not think they're appropriate recruiting tools.
What they're teaching these children is not real. Where's the rest of the Army experience? Killing real people, being responsible for the death of another human being is totally different than pushing a button and playing a video game.
Leary and her fellow activists plan to celebrate when the Army Experience Center officially closes this weekend, though it may be just a matter of time before Xbox consoles turn up at your local recruiting station. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
We've reached that point in the week where a bit of reflection might be in order, 4 minutes or so to digest what's happened the past 5 days, otherwise known as our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. For that, we are joined by Megan McArdle from The Atlantic Magazine, also John Carney from CNBC. Megan, John, good to talk to you both again.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
So, John, we talked a little bit up at the top of the broadcast about gross domestic product. Your very quick gut check on this morning's number, please.
It worries me that business spending is so much farther ahead than consumer spending. That's a typical sign of an economic bubble. It does seem to say that we might be heading for a recovery, but whether or not that's sustainable will depend on whether or not all this business spending is actually going for things that will eventually produce stuff that consumers will spend money on. We're not seeing a sign of a consumer recovery, and that is troubling.
Okay, so Megan, let me ask you this. If, as Mr. Carney says, this is troubling and we don't really know what's going on, what can be done? Is there more stimulus to be had? Forget the political argument for a minute. Is there more stimulus to be had? Can the Fed do something? I mean, where are we?
Well, I think the Fed probably could do something, but the Fed is really worried about inflation. And obviously, there's some argument about whether they should be, but it's not entirely irrational to think that when you pump up the money supply greatly, eventually it has to come down. On the fiscal side, I think the specter that is starting to haunt people a little bit is Japan, where you got this endless years of spending and nothing really to show for it except a bunch of bridges to nowhere. It's not clear that we know in this country how to do effective stimulus. And in fact, it turns out that a lot of the evidence for stimulus is much more contested than the people who are advocating it let on in the initial run-up. And that makes it really, really difficult to decide whether when GDP is still positive, but maybe not where we'd like it to be, is it really a good time to borrow an enormous amount of extra money, take that money out of the capital markets, and eventually commit taxpayers to paying back with higher taxes?
John, let me ask you a question about the politics of this thing. It seems to me that, the election's in what, three-ish months or so.
Right.
But basically, given the way, the economy lags and takes a while to get going, the economic numbers that we have now with unemployment and GDP growth and what have you are basically the numbers we're going to be voting on in November. What do you think?
I think that's absolutely right. And it's not clear exactly who that helps and hurts. We obviously think it usually hurts the party that is in power. So that would be the Democrats. But the Republicans really haven't come forth with very many proposals or even a very strongly articulated opposition to the Obama administration's proposals. So I'm not sure, unless they kind of get with the program and can show what they would do different, how much they'll really be able to benefit for it. We're very far from a contract with America position. The Republicans are highly disorganized and don't really have a platform that they're running on right now.
Megan, what do you think of my "the economy is cooked, so we might as well vote today" theory?
I think that that has actually been evident for a little while. the fact is that the economy would have to be growing just gangbusters, you know, 6% in order to start soaking up some of this extra labor supply. And even then, it's kind of doubtful because the fact is that what employers do at the beginning of a recovery is they don't hire. They put extra shifts on. They do extra overtime. But they don't necessarily try to bring people back from the labor force who have been unemployed. And that's because it's traumatic to fire people. We're in a time of tremendous business uncertainty, and people don't want to take on employees that they're going to have to fire 3 months later if things don't work out. That's probably good for their business and good for the mental health of their managers, but it's really bad for that long-term unemployment figure, which is stretching out longer and longer. And all of those things, when people go to the polls in November, they don't necessarily think about what was the headline GDP figure. They think about what's happening in their own lives. These are people who are seeing their credit tightened. They're seeing the values of their homes still not recovering. And they're seeing still, you know, people who were unemployed 18 months ago still out there pounding the pavements trying to find a job.
Megan McArdle from The Atlantic, John Carney from CNBC. Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, food on trucks? Yeah, it just makes sense.
In terms of business opportunities for chefs and new culinary treats for consumers at a good price point, it's phenomenal.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, a nothing day, a so-so week, a very nice month, though, thank you very much. Dow Industrials barely budged today, dropped a point, closed at 10,465. The NASDAQ ticked up a tenth percent, 3 points, 2254. The S&P 500 ended where it began, 1101. For the week, the Dow put on 0.4%. The NASDAQ took off 0.7%. The S&P 500 gave back a tenth. For the month of July, the major gauges all advanced around 7%, the biggest monthly gain, by the by, since last July. Financial shares were a mixed bag today. J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo both added about a 10%. Bank of America ticked up a fraction. Citigroup gave back 0.4%. Expedia took off after reporting higher than expected quarterly profits. The online travel company's shares soared more than 7.5%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for June. The Institute for Supply Management releases its manufacturing index for July. And feeling creative? Entrepreneurial? August is National Inventors Month. What you got? I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. If you have kids who play video games online, or for that matter, if you play yourself, you know the drill. First, you pay the monthly subscription fee, $15 a month or so, and then you get nickel and dimed to death for all those virtual extras that you really have to have to play the game. This week, Sony said it was going to cut players a break. It's going to start offering one of its Smash Online fantasy games, EverQuest 2, for free. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
The business model was born in Asia, where video game companies had trouble collecting subscription fees because of piracy. Andrew Snyder is president of Live Gamer. He says the companies came up with an a la carte system.
In order to mitigate against piracy, the item-based model was born, so that players would buy a virtual currency and then use that virtual currency to buy weapons, gear, decorative items, avatars, all sorts of different virtual items within the game.
In China, Japan, and Korea, millions of young men play online games for free. But Snyder says there's no limit to what they can spend on virtual goods like a better cyber sword or magic flying boots.
They can spend $1,000 a month, $1,500 a month. And those types of numbers are often reported both in the Asian markets as well as the Western markets.
The growth in the virtual goods market in the U.S. is staggering. In the last 3 years, it's estimated to have gone from around $300 million to almost $2 billion this year. But don't expect video game companies to abandon the subscription model. Greg Short is president of Electronic Entertainment Design and Research.
The investment to produce some of these games can be upwards of $50 to $75 million before they even release the game and start making any money. So the subscription model and traditional sale of goods model allowed them to recoup that investment relatively quickly if they could get critical mass.
In fact, the games being given away in this country often don't have huge paying audiences, which makes it easier for companies to give them away for free. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
So here's the thing about living in Los Angeles. If you're hungry, but you just can't decide what you're in the mood for, you can go out and stand on certain street corners, and the food comes to you.
So what's good?
We basically do an authentic style Philly cheesesteak.
On trucks, retrofitted delivery vans making and selling almost anything you could want. Korean tacos, Chinese dumplings, South Philly cheesesteaks, like I had for lunch the other day.
I think I'll go with the American cheese,
yeah,
with the roasted peppers.
All right, American.
All that mobile goodness doesn't just happen. There is a business to putting those trucks together.
Right now we're walking down sort of gourmet row, which is grilled cheese, Baby's Badass Burgers, Nana Queen's Pudding and Wings, the dumpling station.
Josh Hiller co-owns a company called Road Stoves. It is the go-to place in L.A. for all things food truck. They do business plans to graphic designs to where you park the thing at night. Hiller and his partner have become kingmakers of a sort on the L.A. food truck scene.
You know, we'll sit down, we'll talk about their idea, we'll see what their business plan is. Do we think this is someone that can succeed? We provide a store on site where people buy the actual food and beverage products. We help promote with the iPhone app and the website. And we help train in terms of interior kitchen cooking equipment, driver training.
Getting back to that whole idea thing, though.
We're standing next to the grilled cheese truck now. And when they came to us and they said, look, we have this gourmet grilled cheese concept, my partner Morris said, absolutely, I love it. Let's get you on the road. When people see this big, melty vehicle rolling down the street, they know, you know, heart attack's not far behind.
Before the roving heart attacks, Road Stoves was born like so many other startups. A good idea, some working capital, and a little bit of being in the right place at the right time. In this case, helping a friend get his Korean taco truck started about a year and a half ago. That turned out to be an experiment we now know as the mobile moneymaker Kogi. Hiller figures Kogi nets a couple of $1,000s a day on delicacies like their kimchi quesadillas. You do the math, that's $500,000 a year on the very high end. Just to stay on the road, a truck, Hiller says, has to clear a couple of hundred a day. You remember the cheesesteak truck where I had lunch? We caught up with the owner back on the Road Stoves lot.
I'm Jonathan Salvatore. I run the South Philly Experience truck.
Sounds like you're from Philly.
I'm from South Jersey, but
close enough, right?
Yeah.
He does work pretty long hours.
Typical day, wake up at 6, set the trucks up, try to get the trucks ready by 10:30, get them to lunch by 11:30. They serve lunch, they come back, restock them up, and then they go out again, bars and late night scene.
The South Philly Experience is also having a typical year when it comes to success on the food truck scene.
We're almost a year in, and it gets better every day. We're actually starting our second truck today, so that's why I'm a little behind. I'm trying to work two trucks for the first day.
For every South Philly Experience and Kogi that are expanding and making a profit, Josh Hiller says there are scores more just trying to break in.
We get hundreds of calls a day from people that want trucks. So it's not an issue of, do people want to get into this business? It's really managing the growth so it's palatable for the city, for the police department, for business owners, for consumers. But in terms of business opportunities for chefs and new culinary treats for consumers at a good price point, it's phenomenal.
So phenomenal, in fact, that Hiller says it might be time to take this LA scene and export it. Road Stoves is in talks to launch some trucks in Austin, Texas, and points elsewhere. But he is pretty firm about not taking too much of the credit for the success of food trucks in L.A.
what it all boils down to, no matter what we do, is the food. So these chefs have to provide a product, and that's all on them.
If there were any doubts about how ready the rest of you might be for a food truck explosion, the Food Network just announced a new show. The Great Food Truck Race premieres in a couple of weeks. You can think of it as a cross between The Amazing Race and Top Chef. Two of the contestants, the Nom Nom Truck and Nana Queens, pull out of the Road Stoves lot and onto the small screen August the 15th. I got to tell you, though, you have to see these trucks to really appreciate them. Our slideshow is at marketplace.org. And while you're there, send us pictures of your favorite truck, too.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, it being a Friday and all, what say we get away from the real news and find out what didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Brendan Noonan, Rico Galliano, and select members of the Marketplace staff.
Reporter for Marketplace, Eve Tro. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, I was very excited to see that Zappos is now offering tours of its company in Las Vegas, Nevada. So I might just have to go to Vegas.
Wait, you mean the internet shoe company?
Yes. Zappos is the company, of course, that sells shoes online. I doubt there is a female in the country who doesn't know who that company is.
So what is their pitch? Come marvel at the only company in Nevada that actually provides an actual good and service?
Right. Something that doesn't hurt you. Although a shoe addiction can be just as bad as a gambling addiction, I would say.
Millie Jefferson, assistant producer for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, a court ruled this week that a former executive with Thomas's English Muffins is not allowed to take a job at Hostess.
And why is that?
Because they said he has intimate knowledge of the Nooks and Crannies recipe, and he could take Thomas's recipe, which is a subsidiary of Bimbo's Bakery, and give it to Hostess.
Wait a minute. Bimbo's Bakery?
Yes. It says nothing about the deliciousness of the English muffin, however.
I just want to be in those legal deliberations. We have to defend Bimbo's Nooks and Crannies.
Ethan Lindsay, the producer for the Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, it's official. The Washington Post has dubbed Washington, D.C. as the DMV.
Wait, as a nickname?
Oh, yeah. It's what the kids are calling it these days. It stands for D.C., Maryland, and Virginia.
So they named, like, the biggest bureaucracy in the world after the most inept bureaucracy in the world?
Doesn't it seem like it should be L.A.? L.A. should be the DMV? I mean, we're the ones sitting in our cars all day.
There is more of what Rico and Brendan have to offer on their podcast. It is called The Dinner Party Download, and there is, of course, a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And on this Friday afternoon at the end of July, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave up 1 point. The NASDAQ ticked up a 10%. We'll call that 3 points. The S&P 500 ended right where it started. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Ure. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. If you're a woman thinking about asking for a raise, there are going to be some challenges.
He said, I could get people like you for $10,000 a year and a hot lunch at noon.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. We are back here on Monday.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.